This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
On trees to actually sort of help us mitigate some of these issues related to rising CO2 in the atmosphere.
We know greenhouse gases are a problem. We know we need to make some drastic changes, and soon, to stave off an inexorable slide into planetary dysfunction. What we don't know is how to make sure those changes happen. How do we identify the good policies based on sound science? This week's guests on Sea Change Radio, both longtime friends of mine, are each advancing sustainable public policy in their own ways. First, I speak with Indiana University biology professor Richard Phillips, who's just published an important study on how much trees actually do or don't mitigate carbon emissions. His findings will help ensure more accurate calculations for CO2 emissions from countries like the United States that rely on forests to offset their high rates of pollution. Next, we hear from Seth Berry, an assemblyman from the state of Maine, who gives us an insider's perspective on the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, also known as REGGI, a cap-and-trade system for carbon emissions from power plants with 9 participating U.S. states and some parts of eastern Canada. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by my old friend Richard Phillips. He is an assistant professor of biology at Indiana University. Rich, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Hi, Alex. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you on the show. You came out with a study through, even though you're at Indiana University, the research was conducted at Duke University's free air carbon dioxide enrichment site in North Carolina, and I wanted you to share with our listeners a little bit of the findings from this study.
Sure, Alex. Yeah, I'll tell you a little bit about this. You mentioned the FACE experiment. FACE is an acronym, stands for Free Air Carbon Dioxide Enrichment. And what this is a technology, essentially. It's a series of experiments that were set up around the world. I think there's a couple dozen of them now. And the idea behind the FACE technology, or these FACE sites, was to look at how vegetations and communities, natural ecosystems, respond to things like elevated levels of carbon dioxide. And we knew a lot about how plants and, to a lesser extent, some of the microbes growing in the soil would respond to CO2 based on greenhouse experiments. And that was done largely in the 1980s. There was a lot of research done on sort of small statured plants that were easy to manipulate. But we really wanted to understand the ecosystem effects. So when you don't put something into a chamber and you allow the birds to come in and you allow the winds to blow, and if it's a sunny day, it's warm. If it's a rainy day, the soils get wet. You allow all these environmental factors to sort of exist, but you add one factor that you manipulate. In this case, that's you elevate the levels of atmospheric CO2, and these are levels that are predicted and are almost certainly going to have sometime within the next 50 years, so they're not some outlandish amount of CO2 that these trees will see in their lifetime. And what we really want to do is understand how this ecosystem would respond. And one of the early predictions was that we'd have that the plants would actually grow bigger under elevated CO2. And that's because plants use carbon dioxide to make sugars through the process, remember, from intro biology of photosynthesis. So we assume that if we give them more CO2, we give them basically the substrate that they're going to use to make sugars, they're going to grow bigger. And maybe they can help mitigate some of these climate issues we're having related to elevated levels of carbon dioxide. Well, as it turns out, one of the things that we're finding out is that not all trees behave the same way, and tree species respond similarly to elevated CO2. Some species can show this enhanced growth initially and then peter off over time as other things become limiting to their growth. So now they have a lot of carbon dioxide, but maybe they don't have enough nutrients or don't have enough water to actually perform some of these functions.
And this is a 14-year study. Why don't you walk us back a little bit to the genesis of this study and what the expectations were going into it, Rich?
Sure. So this, in the late 1990s, a number of investigators set up this experiment specifically to look at how these trees, and this was conducted at Loblolly Pine Plantation. Loblolly pine is a fast growing coniferous tree species that's very widely used as a commercially planted in the southeastern United States and represents a really significant amount of timber production in the US. So it's a relevant and important tree species that we need to understand. And the idea was the trees were about 14 years old at the time, and they turned on this carbon dioxide enrichment. This is an open air type experiment. So there were they didn't cover the forest. So if you want to create an artificial atmosphere, previously what people had done is they'd have to put things in a confined space. Well, the whole technology was set up in a way that would enable us and the researchers on the site to fumigate this forest with elevated levels of carbon dioxide, in a way that didn't prevent them from getting the proper sunlight and rain and conditions that they would experience in nature. So the initial predictions were that the trees would probably grow bigger when they received this elevated CO2. But that over time, in probably somewhere between 5 and 10 years, what would happen is the trees would then have all this extra carbon. They would grow bigger, they would make bigger wood and have store more of that carbon in the bole of the tree, in the sort of wood of the tree. But they would run out of nutrients because the soils were not fertile enough to support more growth. So you'd have an initial increase in growth, but then things would flatline and you'd see no net increase in growth after maybe 5 to 10 years. Those were some of the initial predictions. Well, as it turns out, the loblolly pine have a symbiotic association with a fungi that are growing in the soil that allow them to access nutrients in the soil long past the time that we would have expected. And so when we gave the plants the extra CO2, sure, they grew bigger and put more into their wood, but they also allocated an increasing amount or an increasing proportion of the amount that they took up down to this fungi that was growing on their roots that was able to help them proliferate into the soil and get more nutrients so that they could actually continue to grow at this enhanced rate. And that was really surprising for us because our models have predicted that they would probably run out of nutrients in a short period of time.
So what kind of conclusions can you draw from that symbiotic relationship? Is this a good thing or a bad thing that it was drawing extra nutrients from the fungi?
Well, like a lot of these things, good and bad is probably difficult to ascertain. It just sort of suggests that it's a slightly more complicated than we had considered. I'll give you a contrast to that. So around the same time that the Duke experiment was going on, there was a similar experiment that was being conducted at the Oak Ridge National Lab in Tennessee, in Knoxville, Tennessee. And they were doing almost the exact identical thing to what we were doing at Duke. Yet instead of using loblolly pine trees, they used a different tree species, one called the sweet gum.
Was it deciduous or coniferous?
This is a deciduous tree species. So in addition to having a different leaf habit, meaning deciduous versus evergreen, it does drop its leaves. There's also one other really unique distinction between these two species that make them sort of good end members or good ones to contrast with each other. And the sweet gum trees have a very different type of symbiotic relationship with the fungi. They're associated with a different type of fungi that are not able to access nutrients in the same way that the ones with the pine trees were. So what you had happened at Oak Ridge was after about 6 to 8 years, actually the initial model predictions were borne out. And it turns out those plants, they grew bigger for the first couple of years, but then very quickly, within somewhere between 5 and 8 years, they started to peter out such that after about 10 to 12 years, whereas the pine were still growing at enhanced rates, the sweet gum were not. So there was no enhancement of growth with CO2 in the sweet gum. And we think that that's because they associate with a different group of mycorrhizal fungi. These are these symbiotic fungi. And as a result of that, that suggests that we can't just bank on trees to actually sort of help us mitigate some of these issues related to rising CO2 in the atmosphere.
Did you think you'd escaped from routine? by changing the script and the scene. Despite all you made of it, you were always afraid of a change. You got a lot on your chest. Well, you can come as my guest, so come on down. Coming down to the ground. There's no better place to run. We got snow upon the mountains. We got rivers down below. We're coming down to the ground. We hear the birds sing.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with Assistant Professor of Biology at Indiana University, Rich Phillips. Rich, so this is much more than studying trees then. It's really studying the soil around trees. And it looks like from your study that these soils may actually boost greenhouse gas emissions more than previously thought, kind of canceling out some of the positive feedback loop that is created by trees in terms of mitigating greenhouse gases. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. And one of the things that we tried to drive home in this article is that when things cycle through the soil pools, when things actually move into the soil, some of those will stay there for long periods of time. So one of the reasons we're interested in carbon sequestration in trees is because trees are generally long-lived. They'll live for 60 to 100 years, depending on different species or the harvesting techniques or regimes that are used. But when carbon is stored in the soil, when detritus and you know branches fall and leaves fall and hit the soil, a lot of that carbon can actually be stored in the soil and can be locked away for a really long period of time. Sometimes hundreds, maybe even thousands of years. If you go out to an old forest and you look in the soil, we can use carbon dating techniques. And we know that a lot of that soil that's in there, a lot of that carbon, excuse me, that's in the soil is thousands of years old. So there's a lot of interest in how much where carbon is going to be stored in an ecosystem. Is it going to be stored in the trees and the wood, or is it going to be stored in the soils? And what our study suggests is that although we know that there's some amount that gets stored in the soils for thousands of years, this process of elevated carbon dioxide, of trees mining the soil for nutrients, what that does is that process, when the fungi are going out and trying to get nutrients, they're actually decomposing the old tissues that are falling down from the plants. And so through that process, carbon dioxide is actually released back up to the atmosphere. So not only is it not stored in the soil, which would be really good from a management perspective, because it would stay there for a really long period of time, but then that CO2, which is the byproduct of this deposition, actually goes back to the atmosphere. And so it's actually not helping us reduce atmospheric CO2 at all.
And we shouldn't be fooled by the term positive feedback loop when we're talking about something like climate change. This is not a good thing that this positive feedback loop leads to ice melting and things like that.
Exactly. It's certainly not positive. And you know, you think of a negative feedback, the classic example is a thermostat. A thermostat keeps your house temperature regulated so that if it gets too hot, then the cool air comes on. If it gets too cold, the warm air or the cool air shuts off. The negative feedback is helps us achieve a more stable climate. And so as we go into systems where we're perturbing them in the way of generating a more positive feedback, we're actually running into a situation where having a less stable and more variable climate, of which we don't know that we've ever seen historically.
So, Rich, what kind of end result could you foresee from your study in terms of policy change? Maybe not just yours, but let's take a lot of these studies as a whole, from more temperate regions to Arctic regions to tropical regions. And when we start seeing, you said there's a lot of similar papers being written right now, and that the science community is starting to get some real answers to this problem. What kind of policy change do you think could help offset this? Where do we put in the mechanisms to create a negative feedback loop so we can have some kind of a control over this climate, which seems to be running away from us?
Sure. Well, to be honest, the links and the number of steps to go from some of our research to policy, there are quite a few. And so I'll put that caveat out there right from the start, because a lot of what we do is basically trying to refine and our understanding of some of these things right now. And so it doesn't always lend to clear policy. However, having said that, I will say one of the things that we're doing with our research, right now, the work that's been conducted at the Duke Faith site, for example, or the Oak Ridge Faith site, and the work we've been doing, is going into, there's a lot of effort and a lot of initiative right now to put this work into computer simulation models that we can better understand what the consequences are of inaction. So it's easy to sort of wave your hands and say, we're all going to hell in a handbasket if we don't do anything. What we really want to know is how much we should do, how rapidly we need to do it, and to what extent should we prioritize in terms of which ecosystems we need to be most concerned about in terms of protection, et cetera. And the research that we've conducted to date, in my view, I think the most important place that it can have is in helping us guide policymakers into figuring out how much we want to give credit to nations that are claiming that they are supporting a lot of forest growth and therefore they should not have to worry about their emissions. So a classic example of this in the recent climate discussions, a sticking point that always comes up is that many nations will say, well, you as the U.S., you're adding all this carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, and so therefore you should regulate your CO2 emissions and you should help us offset, for other countries that are developing and have economies that rely on fossil fuel combustion, you shouldn't be telling us what to do since you're one of the biggest polluters, so to speak. And the answer has always been from many in the U.S. community is that, well, you can't just count on the fact that we're giving off all these emissions. We also have a lot of forests that are taking up and removing a lot of CO2 from the atmosphere. And so what our research suggests is that although that may be true, not all tree species perform the same way. And since almost all of our experiments to date have been done on young trees and really some relatively simple ecosystems, we shouldn't really put our eggs in that basket as a reason or motivation not to be more careful about emissions, because if we do, we may be grossly underestimating or overestimating the potential of our forests to soak up and remove that CO2 from the atmosphere. So I think that's not necessarily a specific policy prescription, but I think that's where this kind of research can blend into the policy debate.
Rich Phillips, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex. A lot of fun. Great to talk to you.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. Stay tuned for my conversation with Assemblyman Seth Berry after this break.
Brought it on down to the post office, but it couldn't fit in a letter. Seemed my worm was awfully cold, so I wrapped it in my sweater. Wanted to go to the desert with it, but they say worms like it wetter.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Seth Berry. He's a state representative from Maine. Seth, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex. It's great to be with you.
So one of the things that you've been involved in and the state of Maine has been at the forefront is helping to shape the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, also known as REGGI. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the evolution of REGGI and where we stand today with it?
I'd be happy to. REGGI was just moving into existence when I came into the legislature, and I was elected first in November of 2006. And I asked to be on the Energy and Utilities Committee because that's an issue that I care about greatly, both sustainable energy policy and also internet and broadband, issues which in my rural state of Maine are very important, and in which the committee also regulates. But Reggie was, as I quickly learned, the germ of an idea which eventually led to a 10-state regional carbon cap and trade system, the first of its kind in the country, with a similar West Coast cap and trade system that came into being at about the same time. But states all the way from Maryland up to Maine, 10 states altogether, ultimately signed on to an agreement that required that all fossil fuel power plants, those that are operating at 25 megawatts or greater, would first cap and then gradually lower their carbon emissions, and would do so using a free market approach called the cap and trade system. And it was designed, interestingly, by relatively conservative thinkers back in the 1980s as a solution to acid rain. A lot of people thought it wouldn't work, including many left-leaning individuals and environmentalists, but in fact it worked quite well. And so it was this this notion that we could create a cap and trade system where if you needed to exceed your carbon allowances, you could buy them on an auction. And that carbon market has since evolved, and large power plants are trading credits that they don't need with one another, and meanwhile raising money. Actually over $1 billion has now been raised, which is then plowed into energy efficiency and is helping to reduce demand for electricity in general. So the whole Reggie system was just getting off the ground, and I was fortunate to be able to be part of the team that designed it and brought it into being.
And how is the coalition of states? How does it work in terms of the power that a state like New York would have in the initiative versus a smaller state in population like Maine?
Well, it's based on the proportion of your participation in the program. So Maine's share, because we use a relatively little share of the electricity market, our share of the proceeds is much, much smaller than the state of New York's. I think as of a year ago or so, there had been nearly $800 million raised in total on the carbon markets, and Maine only had about $25 million of that. But what we've been able to do here is pretty profound, because by investing that in energy efficiency, in weatherization, and in upgrades to some larger energy consumers as well, we've really been able to reduce the demand overall, and that's very helpful.
You're a Democrat representing your district in Maine, and your colleagues across the aisle argue that Reggie can act as a built-in tax on power producers that eventually gets passed down to consumers. What kind of protections do you put in place or has Reggie proposed to limit the ability of power producers to pass these additional costs down to their consumers?
Right. Well, one very important point is that we implemented a kick-out clause where if the price of carbon went above a certain point, then it would be halted at that point, and we would increase the amount of carbon allowances that were available, or cap the price. So having that limitation was very important. But when you look at the big picture, what the cap and trade system has actually been able to do is use a market mechanism to reduce demand and really drive private sector innovation. There are many ways to offset your carbon use and the private sector, large fossil fuel generators have been able to do that. They can invest in efficiency and conservation and find other ways to offset their carbon emissions. And the private sector users of electricity have also been able, especially the large ones who depend on electricity in order to be profitable and depend on affordable electricity, have been able to reduce their electricity consumption by installing more efficient generators and boilers and engines, variable speed engines. Lighting is a big one. And so the big picture is that electricity actually becomes less expensive because you're driving down demand. And as you know, when you have less demand and supply stays about the same, which it does here, you actually reduce the price.
Why don't you tell us where Reggie stands now? I've been reading a little bit about Governor Chris Christie. He's against Reggie and whether there's a way to bring New Jersey back into the fold. Maybe you can bring us up to date on that.
Sure. There are threats from a number of organizations, a number of states, primarily those that are led by Republicans, to withdraw from Reggie. And there have been some issues too with Reggie monies being used to balance state budgets. New York, New Jersey, New Hampshire, all of those have used Reggie proceeds to balance state budgets rather than using them for energy programs. And that's an issue.
How does that work?
The proceeds from Reggie, and again, they're not huge. You know, Maine's share has been, I think we're approaching maybe the $40 million mark at this point in the life of the program. In tough fiscal times, there's a temptation for state legislators to reach into that money, which is meant to be used primarily for energy efficiency, and to balance the state budget instead. But that really defeats the purpose. It's like using tobacco settlement money for, uses other than tobacco cessation and health, which is what it was intended to be for. The system, the energy system as a whole, is what we're trying to change here. And so, I take those threats very seriously. I'm not up to speed right now on which states, seriously looked at withdrawing, but Chris Christie obviously is out there. There was a bill here in Maine. We had a bill in Maine to withdraw from Reggie. Fortunately, that was beaten back in this last legislature.
So a bill needs to be passed by the legislative body. You can't just, a governor of a state can't unilaterally decide for his state or her state that Reggie doesn't make sense for them, or they disagree with it, so they pull out. I'm just wondering what kind of strings are attached to keep these regional states that are involved in the initiative involved in the initiative.
Well, that's a good question. I mean, it differs in the participating states. I mean, there are some obligations that go along with the law that's passed, but the law is different in each of the states. Well, there are common elements in each of the states, but how the money gets used is done differently in different states. Again, efficiency is how it's mostly used, but exactly how you go about that can be interpreted differently. There's a memorandum of understanding which governs Reggie and was signed by 10 governors back in 2005. Many of those governors aren't in office anymore.
Oh, except for one very notable one from Massachusetts, Mitt Romney, right?
Correct. Yes, indeed.
State Representative Seth Berry, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Hey, my pleasure, Alex. It's been great to be with you.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Peter Gabriel and Alex Wise. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.